Well, this morning we're continuing the series that we're working through in the life of Peter, and I think you all know we tried to I try to take breaks and just not teach too much, because what we found is that when I'm not teaching, people apparently stay in our church. So often the process of finding a guest speaker is usually I stare at my computer for a while and think, like, who would be good at this? And I don't know why, but for this one, this morning, and the account in Peter's life that we're getting to, is just immediately when I saw it, I thought, I really want Mandy to talk about this. And I don't know why that came to me, but then this week, her and I got together on Tuesday afternoon, and she's like, here's what I'm thinking about talking about, and I just got really, really excited, and so I'm full of anticipation this morning for what she's going to teach us. So while she's coming up here and getting her notes ready to go, will you stand up and say hello to the people around you, especially people maybe you haven't seen in a while, and take your time.
Good morning. Today we're going to be talking about three passages that work together to basically encompass one major movement in the life of Peter. And a couple things right off the bat. This is account, or the first two accounts are in all four Gospels, which tell us two things. One, it's key. That doesn't happen terribly often. And so this is obviously an important account in both the life of Jesus and the beginning of the church. It also means that there are a lot of different details in each one. Each gospel is written by a different person with a different perspective, different memories and recollections of that encounter. So for the first two stories, I've put the chapters that they're in, but I am basically going to be giving you a patchwork, the best that I can come up with, of what happens over the course of these stories. So if you have questions later, if I say something and then you read it later and you're like, wait a minute, just let me know why I chose the patchwork I did. But so we're going to start off with Jesus' prediction of Peter's denial of him. All of the gospel writers tell us that this conversation happens after the Last Supper in the Garden of Gethsemane. Judas has gone to the leaders. The arrest is imminent this evening. And we get three different contexts over the course of the four gospels in which this prediction happens. Two of them tell us that it's as Jesus is telling the disciples, there's an Old Testament prophecy that when the shepherd is struck, that the sheep will scatter. And I'm telling you that today that will be fulfilled. You will all scatter because of me. But I'm going to go ahead of you to Galilee. And when you've turned back, meet me there. The significance of that is that they don't yet know that he's going to go there after he has died. So they probably at this point still are not sure what's happening. We get the picture that until he's actually crucified, they don't really believe him that he's going to be crucified. But he gives them this instruction that when you've turned back, I will meet you in Galilee. The second context we're given is that they are on their way to the garden and they're arguing about who's going to be greatest. And right after the prediction, Jesus gives them instructions for the night and the days to come. In the middle of all this is where we get Jesus telling Peter, Satan has asked to sift all of you like wheat. And it seems as though he's been given permission to do that, because Jesus says, when you've turned back, Peter, strengthen your brothers. So there's again this kind of ominous sense in which Satan has asked to sift you. It's going to be allowed, but when you come out on the other side of it, your job will be to strengthen the rest of the disciples. And then the third context we're given is Jesus telling them, I am about to go away and you can't yet follow me. But in the meantime, you'll be able to follow me later. Between now and then, love one another as I have loved you. So in all four of these, we see Jesus offering them a warning of what's to happen, instruction for what to do between their scattering and being reunited with him, and then a sense of comfort that there will be a point where they come back together. In all four cases, Peter emphatically insists, even if all of the rest of these deny you, even if all of the rest of them run, I am going to remain with you. I will die with you. I will stay with you. And the reality is that it's already become pretty dangerous for the disciples to be associated with Jesus. There's a sense in which they have already stuck with him. While it's dangerous, while the Pharisees and the other leaders are actively trying to take Jesus down. So they believe that this is true. He believes that this is true, that he really will stick with Jesus. If he hasn't left yet, he's not going to leave. But because he makes this statement and he insists that this is going to be the case, that he will follow Jesus no matter what, Jesus turns to him and specifically says, "Peter, before the rooster crows," meaning before this night is over, "you will have denied that you know me three times." Now, we don't really get to see Peter's response. It's probably safe to assume he continued to argue with Jesus that he wasn't going to leave him. But in all three instances, we have Jesus specifically telling him three times, "You're going to deny that you know me before this night is over." Something that I think is significant in this before we even move on is that, I hate slides, just so you know. There's a reality that even before Peter fails, Jesus has accepted him in his weakness. And I think it's important for us to recognize that God is not surprised or shocked by my failure. He's not surprised or shocked when I sin. I hear people talk sometimes about this idea that they've disappointed God. And I even as a Christian in the background I come from, there's a lot of talk about this idea that, God's will is very narrow and it's very easy to fall off of that. And once you've done that, you're pretty much done. Like, you can still be saved, but as far as God having any kind of purpose for you, if you don't walk that tightrope, then it's done. But the reality is that in order to disappoint God, we have to assume that he has expectations of us that we have failed. And if we believe that God knows what we're going to do, if we believe that he really does understand exactly what we're capable of and exactly what choices we'll make, then we have to recognize we can't disappoint him. And I think a lot of people walk around under this cloud that they've gone too far, they've done too much, and the primary reality to them in the face of their failure is that they are sinful, that they are weak, that they are a disappointment. And I think we have the opportunity to ask the question, is the greater truth that God's love is big enough to cover my sin? That God's grace is wide enough to fill in all my broken places and to make up the difference? I see people paralyzed by this idea that they've failed God. And I think we see in this that God already knows what's in us. He knows us better than we know ourselves. And to believe that we've done something that has shocked him out of loving us is just not true. The next step in the story is Peter's actual denial of Jesus. And this is one where every account has a ton of little details. And so this is the best splicing I can do. Peter and the disciple Jesus loved have followed the crowd that arrested Jesus. So they've dragged Jesus out of the garden. They're following at a distance. The disciple Jesus loved is known in the court, so he's able to get Peter into the courtyard, not all the way into the chamber where Jesus' trial is going to happen, but into the courtyard. And then the disciple Jesus loved goes forward. He goes into where the trial is going to be. These spaces are visible to each other. We don't know by how much, but the atmosphere, if you read this chapter in each of the Gospels, the atmosphere where Jesus is one of increasing frenzy, increasing tension, the volume's going up, the accusations are being screamed, and by the end of the story, they're beating Jesus. So if you've ever been in close proximity to like a fight between two people, or like maybe a group of people at a concert or a sporting event or something where people are starting to really get riled up, there's this sense of tension that's increasing. So we have to recognize that that's the same atmosphere that's happening where Peter is. So if you read these chapters, what's happening with Jesus and what's happening with Peter are happening at the same time. So the first person who questions Peter is the servant girl at the door who works for the high priest. So the one who's kind of guarding the door. What's significant about the fact that we are told she's a servant girl is that she is potentially the least important human being in their country. The fact that they say girl means she's not yet an adult. The fact that she's a woman or a female lets us know that she wouldn't even be allowed to testify in court. And the fact that she's a servant means she has absolutely no rank. So in the face of a question, and all she says is, weren't you with the Galilean? His response is, I don't know or understand what you are talking about, which is a legal, formal Jewish denial of a charge. So he's not just saying, I don't know what you're talking about. The words that he uses are, it's like us saying, I deny the charges. To a servant girl who's asking him a question. So there's obviously something happening in him that he is already struck with some sense of pretty significant fear. He protests too much right out of the gate. The second person is either a second servant girl or the same servant girl. At this point, he's moved around the fire, and it specifies charcoal fire. And I don't want to make too much of the symbolism between this and the next passage, but that detail is included in all of the stories. He's sitting around the fire with the temple guards. So we kind of have the temple police here with him. And again, if we keep in mind that people are probably wondering what's happening, it's the middle of the night. They've drug in this guy from Galilee. It's getting really intense back where the leaders are. There's probably some intimidation for Peter that he's surrounded by temple cops, basically. So this second person now addresses the crowd and says he was with the Nazarene. So she's calling attention to Peter to the rest of the crowd. So this time he says with an oath, I do not know the man. For us, it would be something like, I swear to God, I don't know him. There's this sense in which he takes it a step further and makes this kind of really strong proclamation. I don't know the man. So then we have a third accusation that comes at some point in this. And we actually have two different sources based on the Gospels. So it's possible that there was a third and fourth kind of happening simultaneously. One is a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off back in the garden. This had just happened during the arrest. And this relative says, hey, didn't I see you in the garden? Because there was a mob, basically, that came to arrest Jesus. It wasn't just a few guards. And at the same time, people in the crowd are beginning to recognize his accent as being from Galilee. And so they are beginning to say, you are his disciple. Now, again, if Jesus is currently being beaten, and if the tensions are growing, and if people are growing restless, at this point, Peter's probably pretty scared about what's about to happen. And so this time, he both swears an oath and puts himself under a curse. Now, for us today, that doesn't seem like much. He's not using vulgarity. He actually puts himself under a curse, something like, may God strike me dead if I know the man. We don't really have an equivalent of that because we don't think God actually strikes people dead, but they did. This was a real thing, and oaths and curses were a very real thing to them. So for him to go so far as to say, may God strike me dead if I know the man, he's a little out of his mind at this point. So we have to recognize that the fear that Peter's feeling isn't just that he doesn't want to be associated with Jesus. There is obviously something happening kind of in his core. So what we see happening next is that the rooster crows. And Luke tells us that Jesus looks at Peter. And when Peter looks back at him, he remembers Jesus said that before the rooster crows, I would deny him three times. And they tell us, specifically using the phrase, he runs out weeping bitterly. I think a lot of times we've been beat over the head with the idea of sin and guilt and shame by the Christian church. But the reality is that we can talk about sin as messing up or missing the mark and recognize that it's not something that we're meant to carry around like a chain around our ankles. But the bitterness of sin is real. And there are times when I need to look somebody in the face that I have hurt. Sometimes I need to look Jesus in the eye and feel the weight of what I've done or what I've left undone. It's not a comfortable place to go. And whether it's before God or before another human being, it's very hard to allow ourselves to do that. there are also times that we need to meet the gaze of somebody who has hurt us, who is seeking forgiveness, and we need to be willing to look them in the eye. Sometimes I think we need to bitterly weep. We're a culture that is expert in avoidance. We throw ourselves into our work. We throw ourselves into charity. We throw ourselves into intellectual ponderings about God. We throw ourselves into entertainment. We're really good at skirting the issue and coming up with excuses or explaining away our responsibility. But sometimes feeling the pain can be the first step toward God actually restoring us. Whether it's feeling the pain that's been inflicted on me by acknowledging a wound that I've been trying to shove off is not a big deal, so that I can move towards forgiveness and actually letting that thing go, or feeling the pain of my own sin so that I can move towards repentance. This is kind of a sidebar, but I often wonder if Judas hadn't given himself over to despair, could he have had a similar restoration? And there are prophecies and things like that. That's a heady theological thing, but it's just a question that's out there. Because sometimes once we feel the pain of our sin, we give ourselves over to despair. And so to avoid that, we don't give ourselves over to the pain at all. But I genuinely believe that if we want to follow a path of repentance, the first step is to feel the weight of our sin, not to live in it, not to wallow in it, not to carry it around with us like a pet monkey. It's so that we can recognize the reality of the thing so that it can be let go. Does that make sense? So now we get into the third movement, and one that I think is key to a lot of this. And this one is only in John. So if you want to read along, it's John 21. John 21, and it's kind of a longish passage, so we're going to read verses 1 to 17. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them. And they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was him. Jesus called out to them, friends, haven't you any fish? No, they answered. He said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some. When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. When the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from the shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish you have just caught. So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153, but even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. None of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread, and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said, you know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. So, what thoughts do you have? What pops out? What have you heard? What's significant here? Yeah, a lot of teachers make a point of some synonyms that are used here between the words translated know and the words translated love. I'm not going to go into that because most commentators I read say that there's really not as much significance as that in that as we want there to be. Most of those words are interchangeable throughout the rest of the stories. But there is a shift in the differences or in the words that are used for love and for know, as well as for lambs versus sheep. So Okay, so three times. Why do you think he does that? Okay, so Jesus keeps asking until it hurts, because sometimes we answer off the cuff without really thinking through our response. It's the third time he's appeared to them. So yeah, he's actually appeared something like eight times total, three times to the disciples as a whole, and then individual people, and there's the people on Emmaus. So this is not the first time Peter has been face to face with him. That makes a better story in some ways. Like, this is the moment where they first lock eyes after Jesus, or after Peter denies him, but that's not what's happened. We don't know if any conversation has happened before this about the denial, but they have seen him multiple times at this point. Anything else? There is a charcoal fire in this story. Yes, this should remind us of a previous charcoal fire. Anything else? Yeah, there's an elephant in the room. I often wonder if this is some of why Peter like jumps off the boat rather than just waiting to get there. Like, if you've ever known that you have a really awkward encounter, like in 10 minutes, like that sudden feeling of energy where you just need to do anything to kind of get it worked out of you. I think that I read some of that into this. I don't know if that's actually how Peter is feeling, but okay. So just a few things. Why did Peter go fishing? Anybody have any thoughts on that? Okay, so he's going back to the life that he knew before. I've seen three major explanations. One is kind of resignation. He'd been on this high, like we call them, you know, mountaintop experiences for 3 years, but Jesus is gone now, and it's time to get real and go back to real life, because, you know, Jesus had spoken all these changes into him and told him all these great things were coming, but now Jesus is gone. So he's going to go back to what he knows. Some have said it's defeat at his own failure, that at this point he believes he's disqualified himself, because this reinstatement thing hasn't happened. He's seen Jesus. Jesus hasn't told him that he still has a mission. And so there's this defeat that he has. Or it could just be a restlessness. He doesn't know what to do. So he goes back to what's familiar. But I think regardless, there is some symbolism in this story of him returning back to his life before Jesus. So then the second kind of big question is, why did they listen to the man on the shore? Like, they didn't know it was Jesus yet, but this guy yells to them, hey, why don't you throw the net on the other side of the boat and see if that helps? And they just say, okay. This has happened once before, and they did not just say, okay. They argued with him a little bit, and he was on the boat, and they knew it was Jesus, and so then they decided to do it. The only thing I can guess is that they had an inkling. Like, the air was kind of charged with something's happening, even if they didn't fully understand what yet. So then we see that they have the miraculous catch of fish. You know, Peter puts his clothes back on, swims to shore. Jesus has breakfast. There are like 18 sermons and all of this stuff. Jesus provides for them, but they contribute to the provision by bringing in the haul of fish. But basically, Jesus gives them a chance to kind of get dry, get warm, eat, settle into the whatever conversation is happening around the fire. And then we have Jesus ask the question, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? What's interesting is, for the most part, Jesus has referred to him as Peter. And again, not to make too much of a point, because as Charlie talked about the very first week, Peter had, most people had two or three names. I think it's interesting that Jesus goes back to the name that he was called before he walked with Jesus. Jesus goes to an unfamiliar name between the two of them. And so he asks the question, do you love me more than these? What are these? Yeah, so two main theories. One is that Jesus is asking him, do you love me more than you love these fish? That it's he's basically asking him, do you love your old life, or do you love me enough to continue with the life that you've been living with me? The other, and what I think is probably more accurate, is, do you love me more than these disciples love me? Because we have to remember that the beginning of the end for Peter was when he proclaimed loudly and over again, even if all these other ones leave you, I will not. And he's the one who most publicly denies even knowing Jesus. So there's this sense in which pride, but specifically comparative pride, was obviously an issue for Peter. That when it came down to it, he thought that his identity and strength was in that he was going to stay with Jesus no matter what, even if everybody else left him. And that's the one thing that he wasn't capable of actually following through on. So Jesus asked the first time, "Do you love me more than these?" And then he asks two more times, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" I think that there are a couple of reasons Jesus might have asked it three times. One is that Peter publicly denied Jesus three times. Now, three times with the others listening, Jesus asks Peter if he loves him and then extends the call to lead. So in some ways, on a community level, there is no reason for any of the disciples to ever bring up again that Peter had denied Jesus. What God has forgiven, they are to forget. And I think the same is true for us. Now, that doesn't mean that we stay in abusive relationships or that we don't draw boundaries or change our environment when we're being injured by somebody. But it does mean that we don't really have the right to hold against somebody else what God has already forgiven. So in this moment, Jesus is reinstating Peter in front of the community. I also think that we have a psychological need for forgiveness, and sometimes it's necessary not to just pray a blanket prayer of, "God, please forgive me for the mess that I'm in." I don't know if you've ever suddenly just woken up and realized you have created a real mess around yourself. And when you think back on it, there are about 20 steps that you took along the way. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes it's necessary to go back and relive step by step by step, asking God's forgiveness for each of those, and maybe asking individual people along the way for forgiveness for the things that led you to this mess. Because psychologically, I think we need to unravel all of that. You know, we might ask God to forgive us for this one big place of sin that we've landed in, but in the back of our heads, we haven't actually brought the rest of it to him. And so sometimes for our sake, there needs to be a reliving of what led us to where we are. And I think a third reason is that, and this is kind of what somebody over here said, that we need to be asked the question until we really believe our own answer. In a month, Peter is going to lead the charge in the birth of the church. He's going to preach a sermon that brings thousands of people into their little community. And from that point on, Peter is going to be a visible leader in the church, not just among 12, not just among 20, but among thousands. That could have happened whether or not this conversation happened. It's entirely possible Peter would have continued to do what he was called to do. But if he forgot that the duty he was fulfilling stemmed from his love for Jesus, he would have become a new version of Pharisee. And so I think it's possible that Peter needed to know that Jesus knew that he was going to do what he was going to do out of love for Jesus, not just because it was what he was supposed to do. I think that in this story, and again, there are 100 things you can pull from this, but the two things that I really felt came out of this for us this morning were an encouragement and a question. And the encouragement goes back to what I said near the beginning. Our greatest truth in the face of our weakness can be that God's love is strong and that his grace is big and that it covers everything. I have kind of a, you know, one of the dramatic conversion experiences where I didn't believe in God and then very much came to believe in God. And so I had this season of really feeling God's love for me. Some people have had that, some haven't. I don't think it changes the quality or strength of God's love for you. But for me, it was a very strong sense of God's love for me, of his grace, of his forgiveness. And it was really easy, as years have gone on, to dismiss some of that or to believe that God has gotten tired of me sinning in the same ways over and over again. He's tired of me neglecting my relationship with him and that I've somehow worn it out or used it up or squandered it to the point where there's none left. The scandal of the gospel is that that will never be true, that there is never an irreparable mistake, that there is never a point I can come to where I can't look at God and say, I am sorry, and he will not redeem. My limp can become my strength, and every mistake I've made, every sin I've committed, can become one more picture of the beautiful, scandalous redemption of God in my life. And that is true whether your sin is small or whether your sin is great, no matter how many victims of it there are. And we can look at somebody and say it's unfair, but it's always unfair. And so the grace of God becomes this beautiful scandal and this glorious offense that we all get to participate in and that we don't have the right to ever withhold from somebody else. And then I think there's the question, and this is part, this is where it might get a little cheesy, and if so, I apologize. I just don't know how else to say this stuff. The question is, do you love me? One of the things I love about Imago is that we talk so much about salvation not just being something that's going to happen to me later, but it's something that I live out now. It's something that I can participate in the here and now reality, advancing the kingdom of God on earth through daily decisions to bring love and peace and justice and redemption. But I believe Jesus is more than a symbolic force in the world, that he's represented by these ideals. I also love that here at Imago, we talk about, or we lean into Jesus in his historical, factual world, that we strive to understand him in a context that had a society and a culture and a religion and politics and economics and all of those things. But I do believe that he is more than a historical figure, that he doesn't just exist back then. And as Christians, we believe that there's going to come a day when Jesus will return and he will make all things new and he will redeem everything and it will all be set right. But he's more than a futuristic writer in white. He doesn't just live back then. He doesn't just live there later. And he doesn't just exist today in kind of these nebulous, vague ways. I believe that he's a present reality. And so maybe this is my charismatic background kicking in, but I believe that we're called to love God in all the ways we do here at Imago, and I believe that we love God with our hearts, but I believe it's good for us to remember that we're called to love God with our whole hearts. Many of us are very skeptical of the buddy Jesus that a lot of us have heard, that it's all about my personal relationship with God. And we've needed to embrace a larger understanding of the significance of the gospel and of salvation and of all of those things. But Jesus still promised to abide with us and to make a home with us and to walk with us. And he called us friends and he said he'd never leave us. And there are a million other ways in which God refers to himself as love. He talks about wooing the church and wooing Israel and talks about a love that drove him to a cross. And if we are uncomfortable with talking about that love or don't know how to engage that love, we are missing the heart of the whole point of Christianity. We talk a lot about, if you perform religious duties without loving the people that you're performing them for, 1 Corinthians 13 says that you're a clanging gong and a banging cymbal. But I think the same can be true if we live out those duties and we have a genuine love for each other, but we do it divorced from a love for God, because then it becomes duty that we carry out because we're supposed to. And that makes us the new version of Pharisee. And so there's always a balance between, you need to do the right thing even if you don't feel it, but there also needs to be a reality that we are fostering a love relationship with Jesus. So we're going to step into communion, and I just want you to allow some time to ask the question, do you love me? I think whatever your answer, you can ask him to show you what is one step I can take toward fostering a love relationship with Jesus. And please hear that past like the cheesiness of it, because Peter was a fisherman, probably as much of a guy's guy as you can possibly get. And he told Jesus three times emphatically, "You know that I love you." So the idea of loving Jesus isn't a feminine thing, and it's not a charismatic thing. It's meant to be a real, palpable, tangible thing, and something that drives and motivates everything that we do. So maybe that step for you is going to be facing a belief about him that is scary, or a part of him that you believe is unjust or cruel. Maybe it's shame over a failure in your past or in your present that you just can't get past to look him in the eye. Maybe it's a grudge, a place of unforgiveness that you cannot get past in yourself that you know is not only between you and that person, but is standing between you and God. Maybe it's just that this entire idea is completely foreign to you and you have no idea what it means or looks like to love Jesus. Whatever it is, I believe that we can ask him to capture our hearts, and I believe that we can ask him to woo us, and I believe that intimacy with him is meant to be real. So I'm going to pray. If the communion servers and worship team want to come up while I'm doing that, that would be great. And then, like I said, we have a lot of folks here to take communion, so it's going to take a little bit. So I would just ask that you spend some time really letting Jesus ask you, do you love me?